Now, there are people who carefully watch for the first arrival of robins. And they watch for the emergence of certain plants and other natural phenomena. They are phenologists and study phenology. How does phenology fit in a podcast about the weather and climatology? Well, trust us, it does. I've always liked that song. That is so cute. It's a snappy little ditty to kick off another installment of Jet Streaming, a podcast all about the weather and climatology from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Kathy Werzer, along with two rockin' colleagues. Mark Seely. I didn't get a laugh out of you. Mark Seely, climatology professor from climatology professor from the University of Minnesota, and Minnesota Public Radio meteorologist Paul Huttner. Good to see you two guys.
Hey, Kathy.
Hi. Good to be here.
Thanks. You know, I figure spring is here when I see the first robin. How traditional am I?
You know, it's a good thing. Now, I've understood that there are actually some robins that winter over in this part of the world, maybe some wayward ones, but you're right. A lot of them show up this time of the year.
What's your sure sign of spring?
When my daffodils are up in my yard, and they're up about 2 inches out in the backyard, so there's hope. Spring is here.
Excellent. Mark Seely, what's your
sign of spring? I watch the crocus in the front yard and the lilac bushes in the backyard.
Okay. Those are two good signs.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, joining us via the phone is Professor Mark Schwartz. He's a climatologist. He's in the geography department at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I think he has some bellwether signs of spring. He keeps close track of them because he's with the USA National Phenology Network. Mark Schwartz, welcome.
Hi. It's great to be with you.
Thanks. Well, for folks who might not know about phenology, just give me a thumbnail sketch. What is it?
Well, basically, phenology is about studying the connections between events in the natural world, particularly plants, but also animals, and their relationship to cues that they receive from the environment. So we're looking at things like first leaf and first bloom in plants, but also insect hatches when animals come out of hibernation. And things of that sort, and it's particularly critical and important because it's that connection. It's a way of, say, looking at the changes that we're seeing, like warmer temperatures, and we can tie that into the impacts on the natural world.
Mark, Paul Huttner here. I've heard about the green wave, as they call it in spring, this march of greenery as those first leaves start to come out from south to north, and I read somewhere it moves north about 17 miles a day at sea level. Is that true for us here in the middle part of the country as well?
Well, there's various estimates of how fast it moves. It can move much faster than that or slower than that. It goes back to the old Hopkins bioclimatic law that was actually fairly accurate for the East Coast, but it sort of depends. I've seen it travel across several states in one day when we get one of these really warm spells. And this spring is probably a good example because it marched forward rather rapidly, and then all the cold weather that we had across Missouri and Illinois kind of snuffed it out and actually caused some damage in the plants. And so it's had to regroup and continue its progress forward.
Say, Mark, I'm aware that other nations besides America have phenological networks. For example, there's been one running in the United Kingdom for quite a period of time. Can you share a few thoughts on the importance of this at the mid to high latitude positions that have this real sharp seasonality? Because I think that's where it provides us keys as to the consequences and visual effects of this climate change that everyone talks about.
Well, it's definitely the case that at least phenology as far as the driven by temperature, that the profound changes are in so our neck of the woods, so to speak, here in the mid to upper mid latitudes. And it's also true that our efforts here to establish a national phenology network in the United States are in some ways trying to get us caught up with what's been going on in Europe. They have somewhat different problems in trying to get organized there, and that they've had a lot of national networks that have been working independently, and they're trying to get them together. I guess one of the small advantages of not having much in the U.S. is that when we're getting organized, we're able to attack the process all at once and try to get a unified system. So we're trying to establish observations, but we're also trying to coordinate the data that has been collected by individuals in a few places, bringing in the LILAC data that had been collected starting in the 50s and 60s, and also then once we're all up and running, provide a resource for people to be able to access and use this data.
You know, Mark, can I ask you about Project Budburst? Is that how just normal people can help with some of this?
Well, Project Budburst is a special project targeted to citizen scientists that gives a wide opportunity of a large number of plants. In our regular USA National Phenology Network, we also have a number of tiers of participation. So members of the public are also welcome to sign up and register through our regular page as well.
And Project Budburst, just give me a little bit of a background on that.
The idea of Project Budburst is that when we were having an organizational meeting our second organizational meeting last fall, we were looking for a way to sort of get things launched and try to increase involvement. And subcommittee that was working on things from the citizen science perspective had already had some of these ideas going. They went forth. They were able to get some separate funding to help them move forward with this. And so we're seeing this as sort of an intensive special project to engage citizen scientists within the overall envelope. And the idea is that when we're looking for people that just from the public to monitor plants, we're giving them a pretty wide and large list so that they can find all different sorts of plants to participate in. Our more core observations that we're trying to set up will be a bit more targeted, where we're going to be trying to have indicator plants like the lilac. We have to look at parts of the country like the southeast and the southwest where the lilac doesn't grow. We're looking for other indicator plants there. But then we're also looking to have a more targeted set of native species in those areas that are ecologically appropriate, so that the information will ideally be a bit more valuable for scientists to use.
Mark, we're seeing a lot of studies now these days, spring bloom and timing of snowmelt runoff in the west and the southwest has advanced earlier by 1 to 3 weeks in the spring. They're also saying, some folks, that the range of the Baltimore Oriole may shift north until it is no longer found in Baltimore. Also, the British seem to be on this quite a bit. Britain sees a northward migration of more than 200 species moving north with an average shift of 30 to 60 kilometers as climate change begins to take hold. A lot of these since the late 1970s. Is there a clearinghouse where all of these studies are kind of coming together and taking a look at climate change from a phenology standpoint?
Well, that's part of what we're trying to do. We don't have a full list of all the publications at this point. One of the things that we have been concentrating on is trying to create a meta database of the data sources, and we are also going to eventually be putting together something related to the publications. What we have up on our webpage so far are the publications that have used the LILAC data that have been produced in this country, so we're trying to produce that. There are a couple of websites, though, in Europe that have tried to at least give an overview of the studies that have taken place. And my own work, which has used an approach, a model developed from the indicator plants, has looked at changes in terrestrial land areas in mid-latitudes all around the Northern Hemisphere, and really worked and melded very well with these regional studies, because I found that the onset of spring and its various measures was advancing from the 50s until the present time at a rate of about 1 to 1.5 days per decade, getting earlier at that rate.
Say, Mark, you've mentioned or inferred the longevity of some of these phenological records in a couple of your comments. I'm wondering, in your sampling of data sets out there, do any of them go back further than the 1950s? Are there some, for example, that might go back close to a century?
There may be a few individual stations that that go back that farther, but there really there isn't any network that has continued in the U.S. Now, if you go to Europe, there are a number of examples in Switzerland and Germany and other places where they have records that are more or less continuous going back even into the 1700s.
Wow. That's a deep source of data. That's terrific. I ask that question because in recent decades, we've seen observations of phenological events in Minnesota here, for example, related to lilacs or related to the blossoming of our apple trees. And even over the course of just a few decades, we've seen range in dates that exceeds a month. So a rather wide range in dates for these phenomena.
Yeah, they're and to some degree, it tracks what we've seen in the temperature patterns, that things were considerably later in mid-century, and now particularly since the 50s have moved forward and gotten much earlier. So in some ways, there's nothing particularly surprising about that. What the phenology offers us, though, is, and why it's so much interest to global change scientists, is that it gives us another independent measure of what's going on. We can look at the satellite data, we can look at the temperature records, and we can look at this phenology data, and they're all telling us the same kind of thing. And the phenology data offers us this connection, this ability to try to immediately see what the impacts are on the plants and animals.
Now, give us a website so folks can check on what you're doing.
Okay. The website for the USA National Phenology Network at the moment is www.npn.uwm.edu. That'll take you to the site. The Budburst project is also linked through that page.
Excellent. Now, I have to ask you this before you go. What's your official sign of spring?
Well, obviously for me, it's first leaf on the lilac.
Okay.
Works for me.
It works for us. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you.
That's Professor Mark Schwartz. He's a climatologist in the Geography Department of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He's also with the USA National Phenology Network. And we'd love to hear your observations on the emerging signs of spring, which have been delayed a little bit by storms in the Midwest and East. To tell us, go to the Morning Edition homepage of minnesotapublicradio.org and then click on Jet Streaming. That's the podcast at the right-hand side of the page. You know, gentlemen, there's a topic that dovetails quite nicely with our discussion of phenology. It's the emerging field of biometeorology and animals, how animals are affected by the weather. I can tell you how horses are affected by the weather.
How is that, Kathy?
I'll get to that later. But, Mark, studies out of Great Britain?
Yeah, lots of data are out there supportive of this, the importance of this field. In terms of animal behavior, there's two areas that I'm aware of. One is having to do with dogs, particularly dogs that overwinter in landscapes that frequently have snow cover. Because in the presence of snow cover, they lose all their sources of smells because they're buried below the snow cover. And so as we lose snow cover in the spring, which, of course, is another factor that we might put in our phenological observations, and the ground begins to thaw out, there's all kinds of odors that start to come out of the soil and the decaying vegetation. And it becomes, if you will, Kathy, a sniff fest.
Or a smorgasbord of smell.
A smorgasbord.
How's
a
that?
Wine tasting. All of these things for dogs. Dogs go nuts because, of course, their olfactory senses are orders of magnitude more powerful than ours.
Sure.
And so they can start to scent, for example, some of the sniffing dogs, some of the better dogs are actually good at, as we know, tracking. And they can go across a landscape, and by scent they can tell what other dogs have been across that landscape, maybe not since last fall before the snow fell, or what human beings have been across that landscape, or a variety of other things. So dogs really go nuts in the spring, and I think there must be a little bit of instability there. Maybe by the time we get to summer, they've settled down a little bit. The other thing we get into is with birds, and this is a very important time of year, April and May, for avian pulmonary virus, which is a respiratory disease of our poultry. That would be turkeys and chickens and things like that. And so this time of year is a time of year that veterinarians and livestock managers pay careful attention to that.
See, now I would not have known that. And as a meteorologist and a climatologist, now Mark is expanding into veterinary medicine,
see,
too.
That's
pretty impressive.
Be careful. That's why he's here.
I don't have a stethoscope on or anything like that. But so biometeorology is much broader, though, than that sampling,
yes,
Kathy.
Yes, yes.
It's about plant life and animal life and their response to the environment.
And one of the things, well, I don't actually. We've had cats up until recently. We lost our last one. But one of the things that I love is how people are affected by the weather. We're affected by it as much as everybody else, and we're animals, I guess, so that counts. Sunlight in the spring, we feel up this time of the year. The additional vitamin D that's produced in our systems kind of gives us a feeling of well-being, that increasing daylight that we're experiencing every day. The other thing, too, changes in pressure studies have shown really affect people. Not so much that the pressure is high or the pressure is low, but that the pressure is changing, and it can affect our moods, our joints, all those kind of things. In fact, they've done studies showing that people can't focus quite as well when that pressure is constantly changing. That's it.
Thank you.
That's it.
Just wanted to know. So you had, did you ever notice your cats when you had kitties responding to the weather at all?
Yeah, it was funny because we had four cats at one time. Four, yeah, believe it or not. And in different weather situations, they would respond differently. One would always hide under the bed no matter what the weather was. But one was particularly afraid of thunderstorms. And before thunderstorms, as the pressure would change, she would come. Luna was her name. We named her after the lunar eclipse. She would come around and start kind of whining. And then when the storms really moved in, she would go seek cover somewhere. Very, very skittish around storms.
Huh. You know, someone said they thought cats, dogs, maybe even horses can smell the ozone of lightning. And that's why they know storms are close by. I have no idea if that's true or not. And there is ozone in lightning.
I don't know much about that, but I do know that we notoriously underestimate the sensitivity of animals.
Absolutely.
And, of course, you know more about horses than any of us.
Well, I'm not sure about that. But I can tell you this much. During the springtime months when it gets really windy, most horses that I've worked with in my life, my own now included, Matt, the horse, they just go nuts. They just turn into nutballs. I don't know what it is. It's the wind gets in their nose, and it is kind of part of this scent situation that you were talking about, because horses being prey animals are often nervous when it gets really windy, because the wind affects the way the scent is carried and can block a predator's presence in the horse's mind, of course, and as well as mask certain sounds. So when you're mounted and if you're riding, if it's really windy, hang on.
Yeah.
I know of that for a fact.
Yeah. I can tell you this from answering the phone in a weather center for the last 20 years. Nothing generates more calls and aggravation than wind. When we get a persistent, steady wind that's moderate or high, people get irritated. They get a little uneasy, and they call and let us know about it. It's very, very intriguing.
See? The things you learn here on Jet Streaming.
That's right.
All right. Now, if you have a story about the change in the weather and how it affects animals in your life, tell us by going to the Morning Edition homepage at minnesotapublicradio.org and click on Jet Streaming.
Spring is finally here and we're so well dressed. It's a talent and it's our style. So put on your hat because the forecast is rain clouds.
Well, speaking of clouds, springtime, good time for new cloud formations.
Absolutely. We're getting into the vertical cloud season, and we'll see far more frequency of vertical cloud forms than stratiform cloud or layered cloud forms. And the other thing we'll start to see a little bit more of is something meteorologists call chaotic skies. That is, multiple cloud forms present in the sky overhead. You may see mid-level clouds like alto cumulus, and you may see them combined with cirrus clouds that are at a greater height, and you may even see some low-form clouds below those. So that is a typical of the spring season, actually, Kathy. And we'll start to get into the thunderstorm season, of course, and start to see more cumulonimbus, or the large thunderhead cloud forms, as we get deeper into May and June.
Some of our listeners have already seen that.
Yeah,
especially down south.
They are coming. In fact, in the upper Midwest this weekend, looks like we'll see quite a few of those cumulonimbus clouds. One of the interesting things about clouds in different parts of the country is what we call the ambient air. That's the air mass around the clouds, around storms. Here in much of the Midwest, throughout the east, the middle and eastern parts of the country, there's often so much humidity around thunderstorms that you sometimes can't see these anvil heads. If you've spent a summer out in the southwest and you've been around the monsoon, the summer monsoon as we call it, the ambient air around the thunderstorms is often very dry, very clear, and you can just see the finer details of these beautiful cumulonimbus clouds as they shoot up into the sky and point anvils everywhere. And you get a lot of chaotic skies down there too as well, Mark, but with drier ambient air, create some of the most spectacular sunsets during the summer monsoon in the desert southwest.
That is so beautiful. I love the desert southwest anyway.
Me too.
It's a beautiful place. We have a couple minutes left here. So I think, Paul Huttner, it is up to you to pick a website of the week.
My turn this week.
Yes.
Okay, we talk a lot about climate change here, and it's everybody's talking about it these days. It's kind of the intriguing topic. Great source, a climate change information source, kind of keeps track of all the news articles, some of the studies coming out with climate change. Climatewire.org, climatewire.org, latest news articles, studies on climate change. Kind of a good quick look site just to keep track of the latest things that are coming out week to week.
Oh, that is a good one. And we should also mention the phenology website, the Budburst website that Mark Schwartz talked about earlier.
Very appropriate time of year to be looking at that one.
And that is, by the way, a very cute website. So if you like to spot certain plants as they emerge, check that one out, by the way.
Great name, Budburst.
I like that.
Yeah.
Hey, good job, gentlemen. Good to see you again.
Thanks, Kathy. Great
good to
be
see
here.
You, Kathy.
Thank you so much. That is it for Jet Streaming. We're going to be back next week. Jet Streaming is a podcast produced by Minnesota Public Radio with invaluable help from Larissa Anderson. We're going to see, of course, Mark and Paul next week. For Mark Seely and Paul Huttner, I'm Kathy Werzer. Keep your eye on the sky. Until next week, this has been Jet Streaming. Thanks for listening.